sleep, Mom. Come on, go to sleep.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it's Murdoch. And welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories. And it's not just the two of us for this episode.
No, in the third chair, we've invited back the man, the myth, the producer, Producer Leif.
Another day in paradise.
We are the story guys at gmail.com is how you get us your questions. And from the mailbag, Jeff wrote the show to say, Brian, you want to read the letter?
Yeah, this is Mailman Jeff. He's written the show before. Thanks for listening, dude.
Oh,
thanks,
Mailman Jeff. That's right.
Thanks for slinging the mail with Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories in your headphones, dude. We appreciate you. Jeff Buckley came up in conversation, and I've never been a fan, although I can attest that he could sing quite well, and that he was a hot dude that was on a gravy train with biscuit wheels. Let's just appreciate Mailman Jeff's ability to write a sentence.
He was like a made guy, like... You know,
continuing here from Mailman Jeff, family history with his folky dad dying young as well. So, yes, he references that there, Murdoch. You're right. It seems we don't really know what happened during his little off-road swim. Was it drug, suicide, or lack of swimming skills? Hope you dudes can get to the bottom of it and educate us curious music fans. Well, thank God we put Leif on this case, and I think he's got things to report.
Let's start at the end on this one, okay? Spoiler alert, we know he dies.
Yep.
How does he die?
Okay.
So, here's how he died. Jeff Buckley drowned in Memphis, Tennessee, May 27th, 1997. A lot of people think that he died in the Mississippi River, but he actually drowned in the Wolf River Harbor, which is a tributary to the Mississippi River.
Also sounds like an album title.
I always thought it was the Mississippi River, too.
So he was fully clothed. And he was singing Led Zeppelin's Whole Lot of Love.
Mm-hmm.
He had a friend who had looked away to move a boombox. Obviously, this is the 90s. Look back, Buckley was gone. Buckley's body was spotted by a riverboat passenger a few days later. But in reality, the more research I did, the more questions seemed to pop up. He was an odd dude.
First time I ever went to New York City, I drove there and I listened to Highway to Hell going through the Lincoln Tunnel. It was like amazing. The entire moment is etched in my brain. And I had to park my car in Midtown. It was freaking weird. And so this dude who worked for Columbia met me. I owe a lot of things to him, and I was a terrible employee for him. I was a terrible employee for lots of people in the 90s, including him. So I'm sorry for everyone. This is the step I'm taking for employee badness. So, but anyway,
he's trying to get sober from being a bad employee.
He got me a parking spot, and I went up to his apartment, and he opened up this box, and it was like a box with just I don't know how many autographed copies of Grace. And he was like, hey, do you want a bunch of these? And I was like, nah, that's all right, man. I totally went, yeah, that's all right, man. I'm good. You know, it was one of those things like at the time where like I hadn't been punched in the face by that record yet at all.
Yeah.
There was like nothing about it going on. So, and I hadn't seen the video and I just didn't care really. But so... Hey, for all of our listeners that are here, and if Jeff Buckley's a new thing, the main thing is that he has a famous biological father. And so that's Tim Buckley. And so you guys are familiar with Tim, right?
I remember trying to listen to him once in college. And I think I went to, I think I had a Tim Buckley record in the college radio station. And I just remember, I don't remember what song, but I remember putting on and being like, oof.
No, me neither. I mean, I know who he is, but... It's never really grown on me.
So tell us what we need to know about Tim Buckley. Somebody give me the primer.
In the 60s and 70s, he was a singer. He was known for his extraordinary vocal range.
Okay, so like his son.
Exactly. He had a lot of output, like a lot of people back then. He had a short 10-year career, but he had 9 studio albums.
That made him work back then, man.
Here's the thing, though. Tim Buckley started out in the folk scene and immediately started bending genres into something that was pretty uniquely his own.
He did alienate a lot of his fans in what was called his sex funk period.
Is that a real thing? Those three
words together are so freaking awesome that I don't know what to say other than why haven't all three of us had our sex funk period sometime?
I think we have. I think I've definitely had mine.
I think I've definitely had a sex funk period. I think that was like, once again, that was probably the 90s for me as well.
Mine was soundtracked by A Tribe Called Quest, The Far Side, and Sade.
So Tim's got this similarity to Dylan. This is the one thing I know about him, right? In that there is this, like, essentially it goes electric period, like there was with Dylan, and I think it doesn't go well. Like, he gets really screwed up financially, and it turns out alienating his entire fan base. And that typically is not good for your pocketbook if you are a folk singer.
Definitely not. Not only was Tim Buckley's pocketbook hurting, but his family life was spiraling out of control. Tim Buckley had a high school sweetheart named Mary Geber. They met in Laura High School in Anaheim, California, 1964.
Mary's in French class, and she gets a note passed to her.
The note was from Tim, and according to Mary, just for the record, I got most of this information from David Brown's book, Green Brother. It's an excellent, excellent resource on both Tim and Jeff Buckley. It was great. Anyway, the note was, quote, a love poem about touching me and what he was inside.
Oh, yikes.
What he could see inside my eyes, what fires he knew lurked inside, the color of my breath.
So Tim Buckley, ABCF, always be closing folky. I was like, if this was Glengarry Glen Ross folk singers trying to close it at the end of the night with girls, like this is Tim's move.
Tim had it going on. So
he had a way with words.
Soon enough, they were dating.
There was like a tremendous amount of physical, mental, and verbal abuse in both of their homes. And if I was going to take a guess, I would assume here that the situation could be diagnosed as a couple of broken people finding solace in each other. Tim starts playing folk shows around Southern California, and Mary starts working at the happiest place on earth. She works at Disneyland.
That's where you work at if you live in Anaheim.
Tim and Mary were the epitome of young love in the mid-60s, obviously. It's like a love story here. They were Romeo and Juliet of Orange County. Everything was going great until Mary ended up pregnant. So you can imagine this news didn't go...
Kids have to come along and ruin everything.
Well, they had to tell their families about it, and it didn't go well.
Their families who were terrible to them anyway.
It went very poorly. Soon enough, the families cooled down a little bit, and they started planning a wedding.
And so it's this outdoor wedding during an autumn heat wave in SoCal. Mary's in a used wedding dress. And right before it was time to walk to the altar, Tim looks over at his best man, a guy who happens to also be a songwriting partner, a guy named Larry Beckett, and he says, I don't think I want to do this.
Yeah.
That's always bad when you have to be talked into it. This is weird. I don't understand how this happened. They found out that Mary wasn't even pregnant. She had a hysterical pregnancy.
That's a thing?
Yeah, I'm not going to Google it. So Tim is now going back and forth to New York, and he's hanging around in the folk scene there trying to establish himself, because there's obviously a big folk scene in New York City. And of course, now he's starting to get all this attention from female fans, right? Crazy. That doesn't really happen with musician guys who have a wife. He begins a relationship with a lady named Jane Goldstein. She travels with Tim from Southern California to New York City. For lack of a better term, she's basically Tim's New York girl.
Now, when Tim would come back from NYC, he would stay in his Hollywood apartment with Mary and, like, kind of pretend to be a husband.
And during one of his journeys back to Southern California, Mary told Tim that she was actually pregnant this time.
I bet that was an awkward conversation.
So Tim, being the charmer that he was, told his wife that she should move back in with her parents, get a job, save some money, and maybe get an abortion.
Yikes. So this relationship, as predicted before, was going to be on the rocks. And there's a point of contention on who gave that ultimatum. Tim's friends say that it was Mary giving Tim the choice of the baby or the career, and Mary contends it was that Tim gave her the ultimatum. the divorce or the abortion.
Okay, so now we finally get to the literal emergence of the star of this story. Mary begins divorce proceedings in the late summer of 66. And on November 17th, 1966, Mary gives birth to Jeffrey Scott Buckley.
Mary and her family actually began calling the baby Scotty. So from most accounts, Tim would go try and see little Scotty those first few years.
Mary began a relationship with a man named Ron Moorhead and eventually married him. And though Ron never adopted young Scotty, Mary started putting Scotty's last name as Moorhead instead of Buckley on forms at school.
Okay, so if you dig into this, it's pretty unclear how much time Tim ever actually spends with Jeff Buckley. Buckley will say when he is adult and this connection comes out and there's interviews and people ask him, he'll say he only met his father once, that he never spent time with him. That becomes a reoccurring talking point.
During my research, I watched a few documentaries about Jeff Buckley, and in one of the documentaries, it was a BBC production, I think it was in 2002, called Jeff Buckley, Everybody Here Wants You. The narrator states that Mary dropped off young Scotty with Tim for a week. And Brown's book actually backs this up as well. And that after that week, young Scotty, I think he was like 7 or 8 years old, declared that from then on, he wanted to be called Jeff Buckley.
And according to Jeff's website to this day, his mother says, Jeff chose to change his registered name after Tim Buckley died. The circumstances surrounding that decision are entirely too private and personal to share here, but I was totally supportive of this choice.
Well, and we talk about this all the time, right? Part of the challenge of researching the show is that it can be very hard to figure out what's truth and what's myth, especially when you're talking about somebody's origin story.
Especially with people that have died. I mean, Jeff Buckley died almost 30 years ago, and his father died almost 50. Tim Buckley died June 29th, 1975. He had been slowly getting more people to come to his shows. He was finally reconnecting with his audience, and he had recently sold out a show in Dallas with 1,800 tickets. And he had just come back home to Southern California, and he decided to celebrate.
Celebrate good time. Come on. Or in this case, drinking and snorting a bunch of heroin.
At this point, there's another wife, right? And another son.
Yeah.
That wife puts him to bed drunk one night on this celebration weekend, and he just doesn't wake up. It's not a sexy way to go.
No. And so now we have Jeff growing up in Orange County with his mom. Once again, things weren't going very well for Mary and Ron. And I know this is going to shock everybody after all this other marriage advice we've given. Having another child does not help smooth things over anymore.
When Tim Buckley died, supposedly Jeff and Mary are not invited to the funeral?
Mary's now a single mom with two children. And these years have been pretty rough. Jeff Buckley said in an interview one time that they were trailer park trash. And his mother disputes that. But they did bounce around a whole bunch in Southern California, different schools, and she had a lot of different jobs as well.
And eventually, Jeff talked to his mom about settling down and saying, I want to just stay in one place. So he uses his grandmother's address, and he starts going to Anaheim's Laura High School, same place his dad went.
Where he was classmates with Eric and Gwen Stefani.
Really?
The Stefani siblings, yeah.
They're that same age?
She was a freshman when he was a senior.
Okay.
Yeah. So in the middle of high school, Jeff's mom got a job a few hours away. So Jeff lived with his grandmother. He put his foot down. He said, I'm not switching schools again.
And so this is where the music starts. Jeff plays in any band he can find, and except for No Doubt, he doesn't make it into there. His love of music was broad. There's all sorts of influences coming at him, I mean, he likes everything.
They would do MC5 covers. Like, he does Nina Simone. Like, he likes prog rock stuff, like Rush.
And Genesis, you know, for me, it always comes
back. Always comes back from Genesis. It's the only way we get you to do episodes. Like, you can bring Genesis into this episode. Murdoch talks about Kiss and Crew. You talk about Genesis.
The first two CDs I ever bought, I bought them at the same time. Nirvana's Nevermind and Phil Collins' But Seriously Live. I guarantee you I'm the only person ever in the history that bought those two albums at the same time. Okay, so quick aside, this is once again going back to my teaching. I had this kid recently tell me, he said, Mr. Vince, I emailed you something. And I said, that's weird. I haven't gotten anything. Let me check my email again. I said, what email address did you send it to? And he said, he looked me dead in the eyes and he said, no reply at, and I had to stop. I had to stop him and explain to him that that wasn't my email address or it wasn't anybody's email address because that doesn't exist. And for the rest of the day, I had Genesis no reply stuck in my head.
Oh, man.
Oh, I was singing the hell out of it.
All right. So Buckley was jamming Genesis and hanging around Southern California throughout the mid to late 80s. I mean, there's a period in the early 80s. There's no way if he was listening to the radio, he could avoid the guys in Genesis because they owned the radio in the early 80s. So he goes to the Musicians Institute in Los Angeles. But later, he will famously call it a waste of time. And then he does some studio musician stuff. And in the 90s, he eventually, like his dad did two decades before him, makes his way, much like young Murdoch, to NYC.
It's 91. Jeff is like, things are really starting to happen for him. He's joined a band called Gods and Monsters.
Great
and
name for
that. That was formed by a guy named Gary Lucas, who used to play at Captain Beefheart's band.
We talked about that guy.
Far out. They started to do some show, but Jeff's still mostly a guitar guy at this point, and he's not known as a singer.
This is right in our wheelhouse here, because I know how we both are big-time SNL guys. So the music producer for all the sketches on SNL used to be a guy named Hal Wilner.
Uh-huh.
And he began working... He was producing a Tim Buckley tribute show at a church in New York City back in 1991. And he had tasked a lady named Janine Nichols with talking to Tim Buckley's old manager, a guy named Herb Cohen, to get some publicity photos to help promote the show. And then Herb dropped the bomb on Janine that Tim actually had a son and that he was a much better musician than his father.
So that's funny that that's the reputation, right? He's even better than his dad. So they approach Jeff about being in this tribute, and he's like not very interested because he didn't really have that much of a relationship with Tim. Right. So, yeah, biologically, he shares DNA, but it wasn't like he's like, yeah, me and dad, we used to go fishing. You know, like maybe there was a week, right? We just sort of went through all that. So he feels a little sheepish. Finally, reluctantly, he agrees to it. And there's this story that his mom wants to know why he would do something like this. And this comes back to what I mentioned earlier, which is he throws out, listen, I couldn't even go to the funeral. So let me treat this like a way of paying my respects and getting some closure.
And it's kind of a way of, if he had to really step through any grief, like maybe this is just a different way of doing it. So keep in mind, no one knows who the hell Jeff Buckley is. And he walks into this place and he sings the song called I Never Asked to Be Your Mountain, which is a song his father wrote about being a husband and a father. And everyone in the place, their jaws just hit the ground. Now, that's how they meet it.
But it doesn't immediately get Jeff Buckley paid. The guy needs cash. And so this is not an aside. This is going to make sense. Do y'all remember the movie The Commitments?
Oh, that's a great flick, dude.
Yeah.
After the movie came out, the fictitious band actually toured the United States in 1991.
Really?
And Jeff Buckley was a guitar tech for them. And Jeff Buckley and Glenn Hansard of the Frames fame and the movie Once, they start to pal around while they're on tour.
So there's a newish Irish bar in New York that's always on the hunt for people to play at this time, especially Irish bands and singers. And it was called Shanae. And so they called up Glenn Hansard about bringing this entire fictitious/non-fictitious band to play. And Glenn said he couldn't bring the entire band, but he and his buddy Jeff would come and sing some songs.
And this pretty quickly leads to Jeff performing at this small East Village club on a weekly basis, and record company people start showing up on the regular, and eventually they record one of the shows, and it is a gorgeous piece of work that I like better than any of the studio recordings he has.
Yeah, his shows at the Chennai were the place to be. So eventually Columbia Records, they signed.
Let's talk about Jeff Buckley and his personality. Obviously, Jeff Buckley grows up with a tough home life. He has issues dealing with his father or lack thereof. People always will describe him as being quiet and sensitive. But now he's been in New York for a little bit. And he gets into the avant-garde scene in New York.
Yeah. Avant-garde is not really my scene, but in...
It's a lot of ways I describe you. Lots of ways I describe you. Handsome, yes, intelligent, like, kind.
Not an avant-garde.
Avant-garde is not one of the words.
So in these documentaries that I watched, they have video of Jeff Buckley just getting up on stage, acting weird, and playing some weird modern shofar.
Oh, dude, seriously? Like, biblical? Like, do we get to talk about the Bible? Yep. Oh, man. This is fun. This is fun. Murdoch, last time Leif was on the show, we ended up talking about Zacchaeus. So get ready. Now we're going to talk about a shofar. Do you know what this is offhand?
Do I know what this is? No, I don't know what the fuck.
Sounds like a. I thought you were going to. I thought there was some tie in to like a crew record I've never heard.
You fooled me there.
I wish I had any guess at all. Like, no idea what it is.
So a shofar is a ram's horn. And in the Jewish tradition, it's celebrated as a symbol of God protecting Isaac when Abraham, who is Isaac's dad, was considered sacrificing his son on an altar. This is a whole messed up Bible story, right? So they slaughter a ram instead, and the horn is supposed to be the symbol of faithfulness.
You know someone's extremely good looking if they show up to watch him playing a biblical horn.
Slaying with a shofar.
Because that's freaking Jeff Buckley.
Playing with a shofar. Yeah, it sounds like a new dating show on the Peacock. That is. But back to Jeff Buckley. Let's get it back. Jeff was playing at the Chennai a lot. And like Murdoch said, they recorded a live EP there. Jeff Buckley live at the Chennai. That was the first thing that Columbia actually put out.
And the EP, the EP featured two original songs that eventually land on Grace, and then there's two covers. So Jeff originally complained to Hal Warner that the mix made him sound like Loverboy. Can we stop for a minute? I don't want to necessarily talk about Loverboy, but I remember hearing that after they mix Nevermind, after Andy Wallace mixed Nevermind, that Kurt Cobain made a comment like it sounded like Motley Crue or something, like he hated the mix, that it sounded something like that. Loverboy, that sounds like that would be pretty insulting when you're trying to do like a Nina Simone cover.
Well, and it's funny to me too, because like Jeff Buckley, back to Leif's original point, like there's been all this myth around Jeff Buckley. And really back to Mailman Jeff's point, right? Like there's always been this sort of, oh, he's so sexy and he's so interesting and he's so mysterious. So I sort of think of him out of time. Like I don't think of him as existing in the same universe as the Loverboy. So the idea that this avant-garde bro is like also jamming, working for the weekend on occasion enough to know what it sounds like and make a reference to it, that makes me happy.
Hey, listen, I'm loving every minute of it. Anyway,
every minute of it.
So Jeff told Columbia to not use his father's name in any of the promotion of the music, which they did because they could and they did. And then, you know, they held up their end of the bargain.
So Jeff starts working on his first and ultimately the only studio album. If you know anything about Jeff, you know Grace. You've seen the album cover, right? It was a tedious process for Jeff Buckley. He wanted everything to be perfect. He'd like just to take after take of all the songs. And he even had to take a 2-day break from recording because Newsday published a review of his live EP and they compared it to Michael Bolton and he lost his mind.
Ooh,
is that, which one's worse? Let's take a vote. Michael Bolton or Loverboy?
Michael Bolton.
Which one would you like not want to be compared to?
Michael Bolton, even though my trivia team name is Michael Bolton.
I'm going to show up at your next trivia night as Time, Love, and Tenderness.
Hey, since we haven't talked about Kiss at all, Michael Bolton wrote Forever with Paul Stanley. It was their last top 10 hit.
I like how he inserts that in every episode, like someone asks from the audience.
That's right. That's right, Janine. Michael Bolton wrote a top 10 hit with Paul Stanley in 1990 for the Hot in the Shade record.
And lucky for you, ladies and gentlemen, he's here tonight, Paul Stanley. All right, so Columbia releases Grace in 1994, okay? And the album gets some tepid reviews. Rolling Stone calls, they give it 3 stars, but there's nothing super, high in their praise. So the opening single is Grace, which I don't know if most people know that song offhand. That's released in August of 94.
Even Hal Wilner said that he didn't care for the album at first.
Yeah, maybe he wanted to sound like kind of Turn Me Loose. Like, I like that Lover Boy song. That's a good. Yeah,
the amount of Lover Boy songs at the tip of your tongue at your command is impressive. I appreciate it.
You know, all I can think about is Mike Reno wearing that red leather outfit.
Oh, so, but Wilner did say that the album needed to grow on you.
That's what you want to hear. That's what you want. That's what you want everyone involved with your record to say. You know, it's like skanky beer. Like, you just have to have a few and then a few more and then vomit. Okay, really knows how to talk.
The album did not sell well at first. It only sold 2,000 copies in the first week. So Jeff did what a lot of people did before him and after him. He started touring relentlessly. First it was the United States, then eventually abroad to help support his album. He started playing shows. Jeff definitely enjoyed playing shows instead of doing publicity. He had a 14-page marketing campaign that, like we previously said, not talking about his father, not doing MTV, and he would only talk to fanzines, not corporate magazines.
I love the avant-garde spirit.
At some point, he realized that he had to be a part of the machine. He did appear actually on MTV's 120 Minutes, and he and the band performed 3 of the songs, Last Goodbye, So Real, and the aforementioned Grace.
And I watched that on that night when it was on TV.
So we talked about the fact that Buckley was very much into this avant-garde side of New York City. And so his views on the record business side of things were less than enthusiastic.
And he and his band were also routinely doing a cover of Big Star's Kangaroo and doing it like 20 minutes, doing the extended version. There's not a lot of things happening in that song. So this spawned a staff meeting at Columbia in which one executive asked the very simple question, what the fuck is Jeff Buckley doing?
So they have to get him to give, right? I mean, he's just doing things to sabotage himself, basically. And so they finally come to him and they're like, give us one video. And the video they get him to do is for a song called Last Goodbye. And all of a sudden, MTV starts playing and a record starts selling. And Jeff's not only becoming more and more popular, he's named one of People Magazine's 50 Most Beautiful People of the Year. And let me tell you, that is not what an avant-garde rocker from New York City wants to hear.
No, his friends, according to Brown's book, would call him up and talk about that, and it made him very, very uncomfortable. So 2 years, Buckley, his band, they keep touring. Columbia begins to get a little tired of his bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, this is still early 90s, so it's not quite as intense as the early 80s in terms of how fast the output was coming in the 70s and 80s, like we talk about on the show. But they're still wanting something because they don't have the internet and viral videos and all that. Like, they've pushed this thing with Last Goodbye way longer than it should have been able to last with its late start. And so the other thing that complicates this whole thing is the band is a rotating cast of people. We talked about this with the Pretenders recently, right? There's not a lot of consistency. And guess what makes bosses nervous? Inconsistency.
So Buckley and the band, they hit the studio with Tom Verlaine from Television in New York, which should have been a
should have
new
been
album.
Amazing.
The working title, which we get now, is My Sweetheart the Drunk.
These first few recordings, Buckley and his band hated them. They despised them. And it was only about four tracks. He hated everything. He wanted to start fresh.
This is where he insists on this change of scenery, right? So they'd gone on tour in Australia, and he took this band from Memphis with him called the Grifters.
Hell yes. I did some embarrassing yelling, wooing, asking for songs, and hollering at the Grifters more than once, that where I wish I could meet all of them in a room and apologize.
Well, so
I love the Grifters.
Their connection to me is that Roy Barry from the Grifters is now in the band Lucero, which is a Brian Hall of Fame, like not a favorite band of mine, but like a band that played a very important role in my life because of how often I saw them during a certain period. And I've seen them a few times recently. They're back on tour with another band I love now called the Menzingers. They're amazing. But yeah, he's the dude in that band that you're like, who's that guy? What's he doing in that band? That's him. But Roy Barry and David Shouse both told Buckley about Memphis. And they're like, there's a great studio down here that you can record at.
Yeah. And let's get specific. Easily, McCain Studios is there, and lots of great musicians have recorded their records there. White Stripes, Wilco, John Spencer Blues, Explosion, Modest Mouse, Towns Van Zandt, Pavement, Sonic Youth, just tons.
Buckley moved out of the avant-garde scene, and he was now jumping headfirst in this Memphis music scene. Obviously, totally different vibes. His band had come down to from New York City to record a few songs, and they played at a few gigs at a bar called Barristers. From what I can read about these Barrister gigs, it seems like it was sort of one of those first days back in Chennai. He sort of recaptured that magic. He eventually sent his band back to New York City, and he started writing a lot more.
And he doesn't obviously like this pressure and recognition, that newfound fame that he was getting. It was getting to him like kind of, you know, like an allergy that happens to musicians. So in Memphis, he could just be a guy playing music out in a bar because Memphis is full of those kinds of people.
Now we are finally back to the original question from Mailman Jeff. What happened that night in late May?
So I understand it this way. Jeff was expecting his band to get into Memphis. They're going to rehearse in this space downtown. The producer of the new album is due in town about a month later. So there's Jeff and his buddy who had been working as a roadie for him named Keith Foti, and they had decided to take a look at this recording space while another roadie was going to go to the airport and pick up the band. Bowen was worried that Buckley and Foti would forget the directions to the rehearsal space, but by the time he went to remind them of where it was, they'd already left.
Bowen was right. He knew his guys. They totally got lost. Buckley and Foti eventually found themselves down on the riverside in Memphis, down near Beale Street. And they parked their van right next to the old Mud Island monorail. Buckley and Foti, they set out to go on the beach. Whenever I say the word beach, sand comes to mind. That's not what the beach is in Memphis. It's just a large riverbank of large stones and rocks.
As you describe this, I feel like it's important to point out that anything you read about this will tell you that the city of Memphis had an ordinance that you were not supposed to swim in Wolf River Harbor. Strictly prohibited, I think is the term. It was known for this wicked undercurrent that it had, right? And so locals knew that even though it was only like 100 feet from the shore of downtown to the shore of Mud Island, that was not a swim you were supposed to take. There was horror stories. There was one even right around this time, like within a year of this happening, where a guy had decided to swim across the harbor and try to sneak into the Mud Island amphitheater to go to Horde, which...
Oh my gosh, Horde. it was erased from my memory. Keep going.
I mean, should we stop for a second? That was, if you do not know what Horde was, that was Blues Traveler's jam answer to Lollapalooza. And I feel like it's faded from history. Like, people don't talk about Horde. But it was a whole thing that was around for a long time. This, like, just let's make a note. That might need to be a future episode. Anyway.
I think so.
His body washed up on the banks of the Mississippi River. This guy who had been trying to go to Horde, his body got caught in this undercurrent. Again, not far actually from the bank to the island, but it was wicked enough to where he's like missing for 3 days and then washes up on the banks of the Mississippi.
So it's Memphis, it's May, it's hot, and it's closing in on 9 p.m. so it's dark. So Jeff begins to walk out into the harbor. He's walking into the water and he's fully clothed and he's wearing boots because he was obviously just walking across this bank of rocks next to the river, and he starts slowly wading into the river more, and then he starts to do the backstroke into the river.
And he's once again starts singing Zeppelin's Whole Lot of Love, and then he decides to start swimming to the other side. A tugboat passes by, and Fody turns to make sure that his boombox doesn't get swept away in the river. And he's trying to warn Jeff. When he turns back, Jeff Buckley's gone.
And you said this earlier, but it takes a few days, and Buckley's body gets spotted by someone on a riverboat tour. Toxicology reports come back, and they find that although he had a little bit of alcohol in his body, wouldn't have been certified as legally drunk, and there were no drugs.
Right. And I think the reason people wondered if it was a suicide, because he was apparently a really strong swimmer.
Yeah, but we have a lot of evidence that this is a dangerous, even for strong swimmers.
Ultimately, what happened in my view is that Jeff Buckley just made a mistake. He was a little bit reckless. Now, all three of us, we live by the Ohio River, and we understand it enough to respect it and to fear it. There's zero chance I would ever step foot in that river.
I went down to the river right after I moved here, and I was by myself.
That sounds like a religious experience. I went down to the river.
No, it wasn't. And I was by myself, and then there just came just a big ass horse somebody had thrown in the river. So
that is the most on brand thing ever for your town.
So I just called the cops, and I was like, I don't know who to tell, man, but I'm standing right by whatever this crappy ass Mexican restaurant here, pretending to be a Mexican restaurant is. And there is a horse that just went by me. Someone just said, dead horse. Terrible person.
Oh, man.
After Buckley's death, that's when this whole mythology began. His album began to sell more and more copies after his death. Here's the really interesting thing. Now we think of Jeff Buckley. First thing anybody thinks of is his cover of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, right? It wasn't even mentioned in his obituary in the New York Times when it came out.
Here's the thing about Buckley for me. So the record comes out in 93. So I'm in college 8 years later, and someone shows me Grace. Last Goodbye is the one that hooked me. But that's been the only Jeff Buckley song I've had a really strong relationship with. And it's because of that moment, music builds, and he goes, oh, what they say, oh, it won't happen to me. That's like literally one of the greatest moments in musical history. That's like in my top five musical moments of all time. And I would be so annoying because I would like, you know, I would have a beer and a half and I'd be in my buddy Colin's room in college. And because his Button, who's come up on the show recently, Button was his roommate. And he had a computer that we trashed by using Napster on it, because I'm really dating myself. And he opened up at one point, this is unrelated to the story, but we trashed it so badly by using Napster and LimeWire, I guess, is maybe what we were using at that point, because Napster maybe was down. And so LimeWire and Kazaa, and he opened up the fucking hard drive and melted part of it and then put it all back together and took it to Best Buy and was like, hey, this computer's messed up. And at the time, Best Buy was just like, okay, and they gave him a brand new one. And then we torched that one too. But I would sit and listen. I would sit and listen to Last Goodbye in their dorm room, and Colin would get so frustrated with me because I would like be singing that like I just did. I will not do it again for illustration purposes, because there is nothing like the freaking chills I get on my arms when he hits that note about, oh, it won't happen to me, waiting for the phone to call or whatever. It's literally the best. It's like a drug. And the mythology like, still grows around this guy, right? Like, another one of the patron saints of this show is the cultural writer Chuck Klosterman. Again, I think he's come up in the last two episodes on this show. Very early in our friendship, and you may not know this, Leif, one of the first things I ever did when I met Murdoch was give him a copy of Killing Yourself to Live, which is a Chuck Klosterman book about rock star deaths, where he takes a trip and he visits all of these places. And he, of course, brings up the Buckley death. And this is how he reckons with it. But how or why Buckley died really doesn't matter at this point. What matters is how his death is perceived by the world. And as far as I can tell, Buckley's demise is viewed 100% positively from an artistic standpoint. There's an entire cult of disciples led, I believe, by Minnie Driver, who project the knowledge of Buckley's death onto his work. And what they then hear on songs like Drown in My Own Tears is something that would not exist if he were alive. It's a simple equation. Buckley is dead, so grace is profound. But this says more about the people who like Buckley than it does about his music or him. Even when it's an accident, dying somehow proves you weren't kidding.
Which says a lot about the Live at the Cine record has a cover of I Shall Be Released on it.
Oh, yeah.
And it will rip your skin off your body. It is like unbelievable.
So Leif, were you a fan at all?
I never liked it. And it's one of those things, even whenever I was doing this research, one day I was driving to school and I just popped it on. It just doesn't move me.
Well, so here's what I will give you as a stepping stone if you just do not get any of it, which is fine. You know, a lot of what he was doing was covers. What he becomes known for, right? So I Shall Be Released. Yes. You know, he covers his dad as his big debut. He, of course, does the Leonard Cohen song. But there is a British piano player named Jamie Cullum, who never got super big in the United States, but he put out a couple of records. Him. And one of the records, I believe, is called 20-something, because he was young when it came out. And he does a lot of covers on that record, and they're sort of like jazz piano style, but he does Lover, You Should Have Come Over. So if you've never really connected with the way Jeff does it, which is a Jeff original, he wrote that, listen to the Jamie Cullum version. I would suggest it.
And what Murdoch said, I Shall Be Released is one of my favorite songs ever. And that's definitely what I need to plug into more like that. So,
all right,
so that's
enough.
Definitely something
I mean, listen, check out. I think it's appropriate that you were the master of ceremonies on this particular episode, because Mailman Jeff, who wrote the letter, also doesn't like Jeff Buckley. So it felt appropriate to put a harsher critic in the driver's seat for this, but you did an excellent job. And I feel like we did it. I think we did okay. If you want to get involved in the show, if you've got a question like Mailman Jeff, you can send that to wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. You can follow us on Instagram and hit us up there too. Thank you for everybody who's been sending us questions that way recently. And that's just Instagram.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. We have a website. It's at wearethestoryguys.com. And when Leif is on the show, we scoop Murdoch over and let him answer this question. So, Murdoch, I'm going to let you ask the question, and Leif's going to answer it.
Leif, until next time, what should everybody keep doing?
Keep telling stories.
This episode of Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories was written and executive produced by Leif Benson. It was edited and produced by Brian Eichenberger. Book the guys for your show or house party at wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. And support the show at patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. The show is property of Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.